The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
On today's show, we discuss QLACs, or Qualified Longevity Annuity Contracts, which are fixed insurance products. QLACs are offered by Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, but are not offered by Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement IRA Show Q&A edition. It stands for questions and answers as we tackle your email questions, and occasionally we'll have a phone call. Actually have a live back and forth question and answer session. Today we've got a pile of emails with questions concerning Social Security as normal. We've got a question about 60-day rollovers as a Roth conversion. QLACs are on the table. IRA distributions after death, and if we get time, some Roth 401k questions. So my name's Chris Stein. Welcome to the show today. I'm here with Jim Salnier, as normal. We are recording this live on Monday afternoon, January 7th, 2019.
We're not live, are we?
Well, yeah.
Broadcasting over the internet live?
Yeah, we always do that on the Q&A show.
Well, I thought it was the EDU show we did that.
No, sir.
No, it's the Q&A show.
Q&A, and we already have someone in listening.
Amazing. Why don't you push that a little more so more people listen? Oh, that's right, because we can answer questions live if someone asks it.
We've always pushed it,
I think. All right. I don't really pay attention at the beginning. This is the first time I'm actually listening to what you say.
Clearly.
So you're doing good.
Why, thank you. No, we're live. If you're interested in calling in with a live question, phone number is 970-530-0556. Laura can connect with you, get you on the air. For most people who want to have kind of a live back and forth, they have the greatest success by calling in the days ahead and have Laura let us know, and then we can carve out some time during the show to make sure to address a live call. That seems to work the best, but we're flexible and open, so if you're listening and want to call in live, 970-530-0556, which, of course, will only work as we're recording this live. So if you're not listening on January 7th, 2019, at approximately 2:56 p.m. Mountain Time, you're listening to a recording, and, of course, we're not going to answer the phone at that time. But we're happy to take your call. You just won't be on the air. So same phone number. That's the office number. It's not a special radio hotline.
Before you start saying we'll take their call if they call the office, we don't.
We answer the call, but we're not going to talk to them live right then. No.
But
if you have a question, you can certainly reach out to us.
Yeah, Laura will take the question perhaps, but you can't get a hold of us.
No, we're not 24/7 radio call-in show.
So. All right. Well, we got a bunch of questions in our stack of stuff, but I do want to welcome our faithful iTunian listeners and Androidian listeners from podcast land. This is the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. We have probably 30 Qs piled up in our queue.
No 30 Qs in the queue.
30 Qs in the queue. I hope to give quite a few A's today. Maybe 4, 5, 6.
Give it our best shot.
Would be good. We have a varied assortment of questions. Just one Social Security question this week. So
that's a bit refreshing. It's usually pretty heavy Social Security.
And as you'll see, that's a very short question.
Perfect.
That's like one of the shortest questions I've ever seen.
Why don't we knock that out first?
We can do that. Yeah. And then we're going to jump into what seems to be one of the more question-laden topics we did, the 60-day rollover as a Roth conversion technique. We have a question from a professional colleague who had some questions on it, and something that I was thinking of with respect to 60-day rollovers as a Roth conversion this morning when I was in the shower. So
instead of singing in the shower, you...
Oh, no, I think...
You finally, ponder 60-day rollovers as a Roth conversion.
There's no singing in my shower. That's a waste of valuable time.
Well, I get it. Well, at your house, you can sing 24-7 because there's no one there to hear you.
There's no one there to hear me.
So no embarrassment. You can just wander throughout the house singing at the top of your lungs and not bothering a soul, assuming your dog isn't bothered by your voice.
My dog has passed away.
Your second dog?
You know I have no dogs.
I'm sorry. I forgot that you... I'm sorry to bring it up. I forgot.
At the moment, I am dogless.
Dogless.
I'm womanless and dogless. It's a very lonely house right now.
I see now why you're so focused on your garden.
And thinking in the shower of 60-day rollovers.
Okay. Got it. Got it.
There's not much
more
to do.
I don't know why I thought your other dog was still here. I'm sorry.
No. Corby died.
Well, we have extra dogs at our house if you want one.
I don't need
a dog. We're fostering a nice... Actually, it's a Doberman Pinscher Husky mix. Mm-hmm. About 12 weeks old. And he's actually a super cool dog.
Is he?
Yeah. But anyway, we'll only have him another week or so.
I'm still hoping to get another Chesapeake Bay Retriever, so we shall see how that goes.
Okay.
All right. We'll begin with the Social Security question first, seeing as that's what you wanted, because it's the shortest one. This is an iTunian from...
Maryland. No, it's not.
No, it's
that's
not.
Another question.
Yeah, no, I have no idea. He didn't put his state. But it begins. Does the income from a business limited liability corporation get subjected to the Social Security's earnings test if I am collecting my Social Security income between the ages of 62 to 65? Do you want to expand on that one?
I'd love to. First of all, you embellished the question because instead of saying LLC, you said
limited liability corporation.
Which I'm going to call out as a pet peeve of mine. It's not corporation, it's company. It is, in fact, not a corporation.
Oh, not in fact a corporation.
Thus,
that is true.
The LLC has its unique business entity classification, not a corporation. So, but a lot of people say that, but it is
very good.
It is a pet peeve of mine.
Throw the man who signs your checks under the bus. I don't mind.
We'll deal with it. Okay, I understood what you meant. So an LLC, and the question is, does income from that get considered in the earnings test for Social Security benefits in the years prior to turning full retirement age? So those of you familiar with the earnings test know that you can earn as much as you want from any source after you reach your full retirement age month without it affecting your Social Security benefits in any way as far as the benefit itself. There's a whole taxation issue, which is separate, but the benefit itself is not affected by earnings after you reach your full retirement age. Prior to that, if you earn too much in the form of wages, it can affect your Social Security benefit itself by reducing it. We've talked about it a lot in the past. I'm not going to go any farther than that, but just wanted to clarify that's what they're referring to here. But you see how I emphasized the word wages. It's wages from work. If this is income from an LLC because you are a member, they're not shareholders or stockholders because, again, it's not a corporation. LLCs have members. If you're a member of an LLC and receive a payout because the LLC was profitable and through the LLC agreement you are owed some of those profits or payouts from the LLC, not considered wages. Now, I think reading between the line, and I say that because it's a one-line email, but I'm guessing they're asking this because they work for the LLC or they're self-employed and have an LLC, and they're hoping that the income they earn from that LLC is not going to be considered for the earnings test. You got to be a little careful here because, of course, if you're classifying payment out from the LLC as member payments and not wages, when in fact you're working for the LLC as an employee of the LLC, you're skirting the law there.
If memory serves me correct, and God, I'm going into the bowels of my memory on this one, when it comes to the earnings test on self-employed people, there's a different test they look at. Isn't it how much time you are dedicating to the work, to the company?
They're going to do that to see if you are manipulating, like I think this person is asking me about, which is how much are you being compensated in wages versus payment as just being a part owner of the business, as a member of the LLC itself. There's tests that the IRS and the Social Security are going to look at there.
In my mind, and again, folks, I apologize if I'm not quite accurate on this, and I'm just pulling this out of my bowels in my brain. I thought it was like if you worked more than 15 hours a week at this self-employed firm, you will be considered employed and the earnings test is going to apply, or something similar to that. I remember this because it would be very easy to manipulate.
Right.
And they're on to that trick. So they look at how much time, or someone who is working now is going to claim Social Security, simply has their salary go to their wife now, say,
right,
who quote unquote works in the main office, and but he is doing all the work. Let's say it's a tire changing factory. He's the one out there putting the tires on, balancing them, rotating them, selling them. But he has all the salary go to the wife, who might come in and do, I don't know, the QuickBooks for a couple hours a week. But all of a sudden, she's getting the big salary, and his Social Security isn't subject to that, to the earnings test. So they look at the hours you're working. If memory serves me correct, they have a rule similar to that.
There's a rule for substantial services. If you work less than 15 hours, there's a 15 hours, you are not considered, you can ignore the test of you're providing substantial services. So if you're working there less than 15 hours, they're not going to question it. If you're working more than 15 hours, then if you worked between 15 and 45 hours, I'm sorry, it's not 15 hours a week, it's 15 hours a month. If you are between 15 and 45 hours a month, you could be considered highly skilled, and they're going to look at, is the income that you're being attributed fair for your level of commitment?
Right, because they don't want you passing it on.
Exactly. That's where they're going to prevent this kind of bypassing the earnings test situation by, gee, I work for myself, but instead of being self-employed, sole proprietor, where things are going to all look like it's coming to me personally, yes, I get to recognize my reasonable costs before they take the net amount and make that your earnings. That's how it works for a sole proprietorship situation. I'll hide my income inside the LLC and then just receive payments as a member and pretend I'm not working there.
Or pass my salary on to my spouse.
Correct.
Who's really not doing much.
Right. So this is one of those things where that is a violation of the rules. You are manipulating things, and you're also probably opening yourself up to a tax manipulation issue as well, for the same reasons, because there's payroll taxes owed on wages but not on distributions. So some people try to be self-employed to avoid payroll taxes, to going to Social Security and Medicare and that sort of thing.
So they're
looking for these things, and some people do get away with it. I'm not saying try it. Certainly, this is a violation. You shouldn't be doing that, and you might get caught and have severe repercussions.
Yeah,
for doing
we're just
so.
And again, we kind of went down a rabbit hole.
So he doesn't say he's doing that.
No,
but
no, 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 no. And like I don't want to imply that.
No,
but this is something that I swear once, twice, three times a year I run across someone asking me a question similar to this. It could be right. someone on a coffee and a second opinion phone call, or a coffee and a second opinion meeting in the office, or I'm just out and about at one of my social events and someone starts asking me about that, because self-employed people start thinking, okay, I want to collect Social Security, but the earnings test is going to impact me. I'm all of a sudden going to start paying my wife a salary, grow her Social Security benefit, and allow mine to come in tax-free. Or the other way around, my husband's salary, and the wife is going to be the self-employed one who all of a sudden magically is working the same, could be 30, 40, 50, 60 hours a week running a business, but all of a sudden their pay is so small, they're not being subject to the earnings test. I knew, and it's 15 hours a month, that's even worse. I knew that there was a test
that's
that
the
Social Security is
going to
do.
Threshold where they're not going to worry about you being truly earning wages, that less than 15 hours a month is so minuscule that they're not going to worry about it. It's when you exceed that,
right? But what
then
I'm,
they're going to look at the balance of how you're paid.
What I'm saying is, if someone tries to manipulate their income, you could get audited by the Social Security Administration. I don't know how they're going to track this, but if they can prove you're working more than 15 hours a month and all of a sudden you're not paying yourself anything, when up till age 62 or 63 or 64 before you turned on Social Security, you were drawing a salary, they're going to come down on you. Even if you're paying your wages to your spouse,
right.
they're going to attribute that to you based on the hours they think you're providing, and you could be subject to the earnings test.
And I have been contacted by a few people who have gotten requests for information about their business from the Social Security Administration that were questions that I thought were very probing, if you will. They asked, for instance, I know one particular person who was chatting with me about a similar issue where they were being questioned about this type of income from the Social Security Administration. They asked to for contact information for their top five clients.
No kidding.
Yeah.
So they wanted
like they
to
were
talk
gonna
to
call
the
them and see. I'm surmising they were going to ask them, how much are you paying these folks, to see if the numbers matched.
And most likely, when you call, who are you working with? Oh, Steve is still answering the phone for me. I mean, that...
Yeah.
So anyways, when it comes to self-employed, and we're not implying that that's what this listener was doing. He had a general question. Right. Hey, is my self-employed income going to count?
Well,
the answer is yes. But if you're trying to manipulate your self-employed income to all of a sudden have none so you can qualify for Social Security without the earnings test, but your business is not being shut down, it's just that all of a sudden people who weren't being paid, i.e. a spouse or a family member, all of a sudden are being paid and the business isn't slowing down any, Social Security may look into that.
Right. But if you're legitimately just receiving payouts from an LLC in which you are a member, those don't count. Because it's not wages. It's wages from work. It's not general income.
Well,
the earnings test is about earnings from work that you've done in the period that you're being paid.
Well, they're probably also going to look at on the LLC Who
all are the members.
Yeah, yeah, who's the absolutely. Member? Are you a decision maker? Are you a general or
right. And if you're the only member?
Yeah, not
it's going to be a little hard because unless the LLC works on automatically without your input at all, you're got to be working there some. So,
okay.
So yeah, just be aware of those.
Well, the short answer,
listener,
is yes, they are going to look at it.
No, the short answer is no. Income from an LLC is not going to affect the earnings test.
Unless he's working.
That's the short answer. That's his question. Do payments from an LLC affect the earnings test?
See, I interpreted that he was working.
I reread it, and he doesn't say a word about that. That's why I went into it. But if you're working there, even though you said you're not, it didn't say one way or the other.
Yeah, he just says, does income from a business LLC? If he's working it, I would say
then
yes.
Then yes, absolutely.
If he's just a non-voting what are they, members?
Members
in the LLC receiving some of the payments out, the answer would be no.
Correct. Very similar to you owning stock in a corporation like General Electric or something. You If they pay a dividend, you weren't working there. You just happened to be one of the owners. And those don't dividend payments don't count towards the earnings test either.
Fair enough.
Okay.
All right. Well, we went down that rabbit hole on a very easy question.
Yeah, that short question turned a little long on the A side, on the answer side.
And then
side.
This question, quite the opposite, quite lengthily.
And hopefully then offset by a short answer.
No. This, again, is being tied to the 60-day rollover as a Roth conversion. And I have a few other thoughts based on what we announced last week. And this kind of ties into some of what came in last week. This comes from a colleague. And I reached out to him. I don't know him personally, but he listens to our podcast. And he had a few other questions, and I do apologize. I have not got to answer his other questions in a personal email that I was trying to do to him on a professional level. But I do want to read his two questions because I thought they were very good. Mm-hmm. And it also got me thinking of what I was considering in the shower this morning to tell to everybody. I suppose I could skip the shower part. It really is not applicable to when I thought of what I thought of. So he begins. Hi.
Well, it provides our listeners a mental visual of George Clooney taking a shower.
True, true. Right. And we received an email from someone.
Since you claim to look like George Clooney on a regular basis.
A listener, and we'll get to his email shortly.
Yeah, we'll see that.
Confirms.
He's never seen a picture of you, Jim.
You go to the website, you can see a picture of me.
Yeah, that's an email. I don't... Okay, go ahead.
I'm telling you, Chris, if you have... It's indisputable.
Okay.
If you have a few drinks and then squint your eyes...
Mm-hmm.
And this is the key part after a few drinks, mm-hmm. strong drinks.
Mm-hmm.
You squint your eyes so close to the light is just about getting through your eyelashes,
mm-hmm.
but it's definitely through and you can see this filtered light.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that while staring at a picture 30 feet away of George Clooney and me.
They look the same.
It's indisputable.
Wow.
It is eerie.
Impressive.
Eerie.
I'll have to try that.
I look like George Clooney.
Okay.
Okay. Jim and Chris, I just spoke with your front desk person, except my apologies at not remembering her name, but she was very nice.
That'd be Laura.
That would be Laura.
Mm-hmm.
And she is very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm a big fan and appreciate what you guys do. And then I don't want to get into all his other accolades. But he lays out a scenario, and he wants our input on the scenario.
Okay.
So, can you consider helping me what each stage in the below process would be called? I'll use numbers for illustration. Let's say on December 15th, 2018, someone takes $50,000 out of their IRA and deposits it in their bank account.
Okay.
The theory is, in theory, this is rather... In theory, this is when someone has an idea of what their final income numbers are going to be for the year, but are not fully sure.
Okay.
You emphasized on your show, and he's referencing the show that we did, the 60-day rollover one. I think that was November 21st. You emphasized that this is actually when the Roth conversion happens. So I want to pause there.
Right.
What were you going to say?
If... ultimately, the money that he's putting in the bank ends up in a Roth IRA within the allowed limit of the 60 days. If that doesn't happen, then no, it's not considered a Roth conversion.
Right.
It's considered a distribution.
But the conversion does happen, mm-hmm. assuming the money does end up going back into a Roth IRA within 60 days. The conversion for tax purposes would be 2018. Mm-hmm. That is, even though the money, as you'll see in a minute, gets put into the Roth the following year in 2019, the conversion happened the day the money left the IRA. But as Chris said, if it doesn't go into a Roth, it is not a conversion. Just taking money out of the IRA does not affect the conversion.
Right. So if you complete it as a conversion within the 60 days... then the effective date is the December 15th in their
Correct.
Story.
Mm-hmm. So, continuing on, he lays out, on January 15th, 2019,
mm-hmm.
Once they have received all their year-end statements showing all their dividends, interest, capital gains, and they know their final income and bonuses and roughly how much they are going to earn, they can determine how much can go into the Roth as a conversion. Mm-hmm. Let's say in this case it's $20,000.
Of the 50. Right.
So they write a check for $20,000 to their Roth IRA custodian. And in the memo, they write 2018 Roth conversion with a letter of instruction outlining the same. Correct.
That sounds great so far.
Excellent. Yeah. Yep. And notice what's happening here, folks. They took out $50,000 a month earlier, December 15th, 2018, last year. January 15th, 2019, they got it all figured out. It's $20,000 they want to actually convert. So they write a check to the custodian, and let's just assume it actually gets to the custodian and is deposited into the Roth on January 15th, 2019.
Yeah, maybe they can go to their local office or something.
Let's say the custodian has a local office and they walk into it, hand them a check on January 15th, 2019. Even though the money gets put into the Roth IRA in 2019, the conversion is considered to have happened when it left the IRA in 2018. So he is correct. In the memo, you would write 2018 Roth conversion. I would put 2018 Roth conversion rollover. Mm-hmm. Just to further.
One little side note, I won't steer us off too far, but since we talked about going to a local office for the custodian, let's pretend for just a second before you continue with the story that they woke up that morning and realized it wasn't January 15th, but it was in fact the last day they had in the 60-day period. And now they're freaked out because they can't get the money in and their IRA custodian does not have a local office. So there's no way they're going to get it in to their regular Roth IRA. Little trick, if you will, or kind of a backup plan. Go to your bank. Go to your bank, have them open up your Roth IRA, or maybe you have one, and just deposit it in there. Get it into the Roth. You can then move the money from Roth to Roth when you have time to do it. But at least you'll get away from that emergency, "Ooh, I missed it by just a day" issue. Because you should be able to, unless it's a weekend or a holiday, of course, if your bank's open, that's kind of a backup plan. People always forget, you can open up a Roth at a bank. They're more than happy to take your money. It's going to be just a deposit account that you happen to have inside of a Roth IRA wrapper.
Most will require you to put it in a CD. And I've told clients before on that, the penalty for cashing in a CD early is 3 months interest. Buy a 6 month CD. You're going to earn about 0.3% interest. Mm-hmm.
But you can never lose money on a CD. The penalties can never make it so you have less.
Penalty is just on the interest.
Right.
So you'll get your money. So absolutely go ahead and do that.
Just a little backup in case you realize, oh, crap, I got to do it today. There is a way to do that.
Okay, so he is correct on that. Then he continues. Also on January 15th, 2019, they write a check for the other $30,000 to an IRA custodian. Mm-hmm. Along with a letter of instruction telling the custodian that this is a 2017 rollover. On your show, you used the year 2017, referencing the November 21st show. And I wonder if you really meant 2018. There was quite a bit of discussion about making certain the person did not violate the one rollover every 360-day rule. I'm trying to reconcile in my mind that both the December 15th, 2018 date and January 15th, 2019 transaction are not, in fact, rollovers. So let me clear the air on a few things. I asked the Ed Slot Group what they thought we should, or a client should, or an iTunian should list in the memo field, not on the conversion. On the conversion, you definitely want a list. On that $20,000 check that was actually going to be a conversion by being put into a Roth, you definitely want a list, not 2019, 2018 Roth conversion rollover. Mm-hmm. I would put that on the memo of the check and in the letter of instruction. And I would have a copy of both of these for when the letter audit comes, because you're going to get letter audited on this for sure. So I would document that. The Ed Slot Group got back to me and recommended don't put anything identifying the rollover as a specific year. Because they said it's too ambiguous.
You mean ambiguous? Huh? That's the word, ambiguous. But you're talking about the other 30,000 they're trying to put
yes.
in. Right. For the 20 that goes to the Roth, you want all that detail, the letter of instruction. But on the other one, yes, it was a misspeak on the radio when we said 2017, because in our story it was all 2018.
Here's what they wrote. Mm-hmm. I would avoid terms like 2017, 18, or 19 rollover, because it is a bit ambiguous. That's what I said. Nailed it.
You did there, yeah.
I would go with saying it is either a 2018 or a 2019 or a 2017 distribution that is being rolled over. That's how they recommend. It's a distribution that is being rolled over. Mm-hmm. And don't identify it by a specific year rollover. The custodian will find it helpful to know where these funds were coming from, obviously. So in this particular case that we described, because, remember, folks, and this is what Chris and I talked about on last week's show, and this is something I want to mention of the brilliance in my shower this morning that I thought of. Remember last week we said, hey, on our November 21st show, we made a mistake. We erred. We said the 365-day clock begins when the money leaves the IRA. That is incorrect. It begins the same time the 60-day clock begins, when you receive constructive receipt of the money. Not when you get the check delivered to your house. And we talked about court cases and private letter rulings where people were on vacation. One person was in jail. Another one had been committed because he was a drunk. And even though the checks were delivered to the house, they never physically got them yet, Chris. Mm-hmm. And the courts have ruled, and in private letter rulings they have ruled, the clock begins on the 60 days when you receive constructive receipt of the money. In other words, you touched the check. Now, Chris and I said, how is someone, meaning the IRS, going to know when you touched the check? That's the hard part. It's going to be your word against their assertion that, hey, I didn't touch the check. Chris, you gave the example of what if you went on a vacation? Mm-hmm. You requested a check be mailed to you, and then you went away for 2 weeks. Like, you went away for a week.
That'd be an easy one to prove through a few records, but the bigger one is just saying, I didn't get it. You know, the mailman didn't deliver it on time.
And I use the reference that when I first moved to Berthoud, Colorado, from Livermore, Colorado, the foothills, I moved to Berthoud 6 years ago in September. That November, a day or two after Thanksgiving, I mailed my father his Christmas gift for that year, 2012. And he promptly got it in April 2013.
Just in time for spring.
Just it was turned into be a spring gift. And it took the post office 6-7 months to deliver it. That could happen with your rollover check. Absolutely. Government's not going to penalize. The IRS isn't going to hold that against you.
Well, but you'll be questioned on it.
You'll be questioned. But there's no way they can tell, we said, because most custodians don't put tracking numbers on these distribution checks.
Right.
So that said, the one-year rule, though, the one per 365 day, that's how I'd rather use it than one per year, the one per 365 day rule Also, that time begins when you receive the check. So he is wondering, the 2015 one on the $30,000, what does he write in the memo?
2019 one.
Well, oh, we said on the first show, that's what he said. We said 2017. Right. We meant 2018.
Right.
So what should he write in the memo? That will be a 2019, as Chris just said. Even though the money came out in 2018, if you got constructive receipt in 2019...
He didn't, though.
Hold, I know.
Okay.
If you got constructive receipt in 2019, you would write 2019 distribution being rolled over. But he clearly states the money came out December 15th.
Right. And put it in the bank, so then
there's no question
he had constructive
receipts. Once that money went into his bank account on December 15th, 2018, that is a 2018
distribution being
rolled over.
Correct.
So mm-hmm. that would be written on the memo. What year you put on the memo for the rollover is going to depend on what year, December 2018, January 2019, you receive constructive receipt of the money. But the year being written on the conversion check is always going to be December of whatever year it is you're taking the money out.
When it went out, correct. Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes this a very unknown strategy. We talked last week about the Itunian who got a hold of me, whose broker was adamant. The one thing she said the broker told her he knew absolutely was true was the money had to be put in the Roth IRA by 2018. And that was probably one of many things that the broker was
yeah.
It had to be out, not in. And that can get anybody because it just makes sense that you figure it should be put into the Roth in that tax year.
Yeah.
But the Ed Slot Group is adamant that that's not the case. Anyways, so last week you and I talked and we said, look, this means you actually might have to do the strategy every other year. You took the money out in 2018, but got constructive receipt in 2019. You have to wait 365 days from 2019 before you could do this strategy again.
Yep.
And then I said, unless you have a spouse and the spouse has an IRA, you just alternate each year. One year, one spouse does the 60-day rollover strategy. Mm-hmm. Next year, the other spouse does the 60-day rollover strategy. But this morning, while showering, I thought of a brilliant workaround.
Before you tell us your brilliance, let me say that the default way to avoid this one-per-year thing is to let the entire amount you distributed become a Roth conversion. Because there's no limit on how many of those you do. The only thing that's going to disrupt this is if you're always trying to put some back in to the traditional IRA, so then it's just a regular 60-day rollover that doesn't end up as a conversion. Those are what they limit to one every 365 days. So if you distribute the $50,000 on December 15th and then January 15th, you say, yeah, that number's fine with me. I'm going to go ahead and roll over the whole thing into my Roth, making it a Roth conversion. Don't have to worry about the 365 rule. It's only if you do what he's describing, which is put some of it in this story, 30,000 of the 50, back into the traditional IRA, that is what's being limited in frequency by the IRS now. That they're not letting you do in the way you used to, have a lot more flexible rules. Now it's one per 365-day per taxpayer.
But with what Chris said is 100% true, but also defeats the purpose of what we're talking about.
No, because in January, maybe they're like, oh, yeah, we're fine with 50.
No. I get that. But the other idea of what we were trying to do is give you a little bit more time to figure it out. And if you can't put all of it into the Roth. Now you're tied to this one per year rule.
Right.
And if you got constructive receipt in January, which we alluded to on the November 21st show, would have been ideal because it gives you all the way to March to figure this out. You're not going to be able to do another rollover as a Roth conversion that year unless you are married and your spouse can do it, or you're brilliant like me in the shower and you think of something else. Guess what I thought of?
Can't wait to hear this.
Well, it didn't dawn on me until this morning. You simply take the money that you were going to move back to your IRA and put it in your 401k. And if you put it in your 401k, a rollover from an IRA to a 401k is not limited by the one per 365-day rule. You can do as many as those as you want every year. It is just a rollover from an IRA to an IRA. So if you are still working, because if you're retired...
So here's the ifs, right? Yeah.
If you're still working, because if you're retired, most 401ks will not accept rollover money. But if you are still working and your 401k allows rollovers
into them,
mm-hmm. This is a very viable strategy.
True.
And I would not give up on even if you are retired. Contact the 401k provider and see if they will still accept rollovers into the plan, even though you are a retired participant. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you are, or if they will, then mm-hmm. you can move the money into the 401k as a rollover, and money from an IRA to a 401k, or from a 401k to an IRA, is not subject to the one per 365-day rule.
That's semi-brilliant.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I only say semi because I'm still having to get over the visual image of you in the shower. But if you would have left that part out, I would have said brilliant. Now,
but only because it came to me while soaping up with my...
Anytime an epiphany can strike at any moment. So one thing I will say, people are wondering, why the heck would the 401k, after you're not working there anymore, allow you to roll in? Some 401k providers, those employers that are providing those plans, are of the mindset that increasing the total number of assets in there minimizes the cost spread among all the participants, so they don't mind having assets grow.
Absolutely.
in the 401k.
The so more money in a 401k, the lower the cost. So person. That's why a lot of 401ks allow them.
Yep. So it could happen. Not all do. So you have to, the
have
two
to
ifs, you've got to, well, it's really the one big,
one big if.
Does your 401k allow rollovers into them, whether you're working there or not, whatever your situation is? That's going to be the key to avoiding this one per year rule for the money you don't want to end up as a Roth conversion.
Absolutely. And that way, if you received constructive receipt this year in 2019, and you'd really like to do this strategy again, you'll be able to. You're not going to have to skip a year. So, thought of that this morning.
Very nice.
I thought so too.
So did we address all of this?
On this email.
Colleagues.
Yes. Good. To which he then sent a second follow-up email.
Yeah, that's okay.
And this one I thought was pretty good because it's kind of similar but different in his question. So he begins, quick question on the 60-day rollover technique for Roth conversions. Mm-hmm. Let's say someone is 69 years old. They turn 70 in March and 70 and a half in September.
Mm-hmm.
Their IRA balance on December 15th, he's fixated on December 15th. Their IRA balance on December 15th is $100,000.
In the year before they're turning 70, mm-hmm. just to follow. Okay, I'm just making sure. You got the notes in front of you. Yep. I don't.
On December 18th, mm-hmm. they do a 60-day rollover and take $20,000.
Yep.
So actually, no, back it up. Someone is 69. Mm-hmm. They turn 70 in March, 70 and a half in September. I interpreted it as that December. So now RMDs are required.
Okay.
So in December, they take $20,000 out, December 18th. In January, after they realize that they can do only a $5,000 Roth conversion, they put $15,000 back into their IRA. Okay?
Yeah.
And that is done on January 28th, well within their 60-day window. What will their RMD for the year be based on? The $80,000 balance that was in the IRA on December 31st after taking out the $20,000? Or should it be based on $95,000 since they moved $15,000 back the following year?
He skipped a step, didn't
he?
What
step?
Well, if it's December of the year they turned 70 and a half, can you still do a rollover prior to taking the RMD for that year? You haven't reached your required beginning date. However, any distributions in a year you're required to take a distribution, the RMD is
first.
Very
good. I did not consider that. Put a ding, ding, ding star on your forehead.
Oh, do I get a semi-brilliant on
you,
my
you
side?
You get a semi-brilliant on your side because yeah. I wrote back to him that the answer is you have to include the December 31st balance plus any outstanding rollovers.
Right. That's the general rule.
That's the general rule, but Chris is correct, listener, and I know you listen all the time, and I'll get a hold of him as well. This was all hypothetical. It wasn't an actual client of his. But Chris hit the nail on the head, and we'll get to that in a second. The general rule for determining required minimum distribution amounts is the December 31st value. But written directly into the IRC, Internal Revenue Code, written directly into that, is it's the December 31st balance plus any outstanding rollovers and Roth recharacterizations. Now, that latter part is moot at this point because you can't recharacterize a Roth conversion anymore. That said, outstanding rollovers can be. And they put that into the law specifically because, no, I wouldn't say fools, creative people were doing a 60-day rollover right at the end of December and had a zero balance.
Drain the balance on the IRA.
And then magically put the money back in January and do it again the following December.
To avoid an RMD was the, was the reason they were trying to do this. Yeah.
But the government, the Congress, and the IRS were onto this long
very
before.
Quickly.
Yeah. So the short answer is you had a client listener who had $100,000, took out 20, had $80,000 on December 31st. The end of January of the following year puts $15,000 back in. The RMD would be based on $95,000.
Right.
Now, that said, assuming the in subsequent years, the RMD is taken first, and then you're playing around with all this, that's how it would work. But Chris is 100% correct. In the example you gave, the person is turning 70 and a half that year, and you never indicated that he took his RMD for that year yet, which would have been based on the previous year's December 31st value.
Right.
It's only next year's, 2019's RMD would be based on the 2018 balance. But the RMDs have to be taken in 2018, which would have been based on the 2017 balance. So your whole question would have been moot at that point. They would have used the 2017 balance to determine the RMD for 2018. But remember, listener, an RMD cannot be rolled over. So you took out $20,000. It's only $100,000 in there. The RMD is going to be about $3,700, assuming there's no other IRAs. So when your client took out that $20,000 and put $5,000 in a Roth as a conversion, you cannot move $15,000 back.
Right.
The RMD of $3,700 approximately
Has to stay out.
Has to stay out. So he or she would have moved back. What would that have been?
15 minus the 3,700, so 11,300. Roughly.
Roughly. Would be moved back. Yep.
So hopefully in his hypothetical, he was thinking, oh, they've already taken the RMD, and now on December 15th, they have 100 grand in there, and then this whole story
and
makes sense.
And the RMD would not be based on the full 15,000. Because the RMD is not an outstanding rollover, because RMDs can never be rolled over.
Right.
So the actual RMD amount would have been the 80,000 December 31st value plus $11,300, mm-hmm. not 15,000.
Right.
Because 15,000 shouldn't have been put in there. Now, if you based the RMD on 15,000, no harm, no foul, you just ended up taking out more than you had to. You're not going to be penalized on that. But if your client moved 15,000 back in, he just made a $3,700 excess contribution, because RMDs cannot be excluded. And one thing to remember, all listeners, because this is a very advanced question he asked, all listeners, remember, even though the client in this case, this hypothetical client that this colleague wrote about, even though they were going to turn 70 and a half in September of last year, 2018, even though they could have delayed their first RMD to April 1st, 2019, beginning in 2018, January of 2018, January 1st of 2018, the first dollars distributed from that IRA will be considered the RMD.
Right. And there's no around that. That's, you can't say, oh, no, don't consider this my RMD. I'm making it a rollover. You don't have that flexibility. By code, the dollars beginning the year that you turn 70 and a half,
even
the
if you
first
delay
dollars,
it to the and, April 1st.
Correct. So you've got, you can delay, but only if you don't take anything out. You got to leave it sit there until you're the point where you've delayed it until April 1st of the following year at the most. You don't have to wait till then, but if you delay it a little bit, you can't have taken anything out before that, or you really haven't delayed. You've started RMDs back in that year that you turned 70.
Absolutely.
And a half.
So here was a very innocuous question that turned into quite a bit of, well, if you look at this, well, if you look at that, if, ands, and buts. So the answer really wasn't the 15,000 plus the 80 that he gave me as one of the choices, even though as my email to him, I said it would be the 95. I totally missed the RMD issue. I was just looking at, the fact that you could not roll over RMDs. I totally missed that in my reply to him. Instead, I was fixated on what the RMD calculation is based on, December 31st value plus any outstanding rollovers. But your RMD, your client's RMD, could not have been put back. So out of the 15,000 you wanted to put back, you had to subtract out the RMD, which would be about $3,700 on a $100,000 IRA. So as Chris said, about $11,300 got moved back, and the RMD would have been based on 80 plus 11,300, so 91,300 would be what the RMD would have been based
for
on
the next
for the
year,
following
for
year,
the 2019.
For the following year, exactly. Yep. But in 2018, it would have been based on the December 31st, 2017 balance anyways.
Right, which maybe was 100 if it just sat there and didn't move at all. But we don't know, because that wasn't part of the story.
Interesting. A lot of caveats on that one.
Yep.
A lot of caveats. You guys might want to listen to this scenario and answer a few times so it can sink in. There's a lot of moving parts to a very, very simple question.
But IRAs are so easy, Jim.
Yeah, I know, huh?
Just put money in, it just stays in there, tax deferred,
no problem,
don't worry about it. No.
I do thank our colleague. I know we have a lot of colleagues who listen to the show. I'm glad we could help out. But wow, good pickup on that, Chris. I'm totally good. I'm going to get a hold of him I do have his personal email and reach out to him and say, hey, listen to the show because we go even deeper into that question than it seemed. And then in the future, you always have to take the RMD first. Then you can do the 60-day rollover technique. Capiche?
Capiche.
Okay. Okay, this begins. Greetings, George Clooney lookalike. I'm just saying.
Tongue in cheek.
No, he's being totally serious here. Mm-hmm. And Baby Driver.
I never saw that movie.
What's Baby Driver?
It's a young guy who I think drove a getaway car for some criminals or something,
and
but
he
was young
in it?
And no.
Oh.
I don't think so.
Hmm. All right. He says, greetings, George Clooney lookalike and Baby Driver. I think he's referencing me.
No.
I'm the only one here who looks like George Clooney.
I know that part, but he's calling me Baby Driver.
Oh, you're Baby Driver. And then he puts in parentheses, Chris does not resemble Baby Huey at all.
See, there you go.
That's the best I can come up with.
Baby Driver.
So in other words, he has no idea what you resemble.
Baby Driver. That's the character.
Is that played by Baby Huey?
No. It's just a young kid.
Oh.
He's reflecting the fact that I'm much younger than you are.
True, you are, but I look much better because I look like George Clooney. If you have a few drinks, put a picture of me and George Clooney about 30 feet away and squint your eyes so tight light mm-hmm. barely comes through.
Yep, at twilight.
At twilight would be even better. It will be unmistakable, the resemblance.
Okay.
Okay. I am considering adding a QLAC. And for those
here
who,
it is.
For those who don't know, QLAC stands for Qualified Longevity Annuity Contract. It is a special type of annuity created by the Department of Labor, well, I guess you could say announced by the Department of Labor in 2010 and rapidly created and came to market in 2015, a mere 5 years later, that will allow people to put a certain amount of money into them. Current limit is $130,000. Did they raise that this year?
That's a good question. I haven't.
I know they raised everything else.
I haven't looked at QLAC data for, let me look it up while you're talking.
Okay. While Chris is looking up what the 2019 limit is, used to be $125,000. They just raised it to $130,000. So I don't think QLAC's got increased this year. I think it's still at $130,000. But allow you to put $130,000 of IRA money into them and defer required minimum distributions on that money only that's in the QLAC until no later than age 85. And then the QLAC, Qualified Longevity Annuity Contract, the QLAC will pay a lifetime stream of income no matter how long you live past 85. Now, 85 is the longest you can defer, folks. You can turn the QLAC on sooner if you so desire. But you have to be careful. Some QLAC companies only allow you to turn it on 5 years sooner than the date you told them you were going to turn it on. So if you told them you were going to turn it on at 85, but you actually want it at 75, some QLAC companies will not let you do that. They'll only let you turn it on 5 years earlier. Other companies that I know of, I don't want to name individual QLAC providers, but other companies that I know of will let you turn it on at any time 18 months after you made the QLAC contribution. So if you opened it at age 70, 18 months after you're 71 and a half, and some QLAC companies will let you turn it on as early as that. So you have to be real careful on what QLAC company you choose, but the long and the short of it is a QLAC is an insurance product that allows you to defer required minimum distributions and create a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. Did you find the number?
It appears to be 130, but it's not. I'm trying to get it from the horse's mouth.
It was 130 last year, so
right.
I don't
and
think
that
it went
had been
up.
Increased from the year before.
Correct.
So I think it's still at 130, but I'm still waiting to find it from the horse's mouth, the IRS. So
I did not see that 2019 QLACs were raised higher than 130. I believe last year's increase was it. So he continues. Where the heck was I? I'm considering adding a QLAC into my plan For my wife, follow along with me here, Chris. I'm considering adding a QLAC into my plan for my wife following my passing because I have a medical condition that reduces my life expectancy to about age 60. We're both 43 now. But I want to know a few things about QLACs, and I can't seem to find the answers. First, is there a minimum age that one can actually be in order to purchase a QLAC? As well as a minimum age you recommend someone should be before buying a QLAC. Second, how does the QLAC actually affect a person's required minimum distributions? I have learned that the most obvious and reasonable assumption about how this should work probably doesn't apply when a government gets involved. I'm not sure I quite understand that last remark, but I think what he's saying is he doesn't trust the government to not change the rule later on. And that's if that is, in fact, what you meant on your last part of the email, the last comment, I wouldn't worry about it, even if they got rid of QLACs, because QLACs are the only insurance product geared specifically for retirees that was essentially thought of, created by the U.S. Department of Treasury. U.S. Department of Treasury doesn't sell them. But they thought of them, they named them. That's an official Department of Acronyms QLAC.
Back when the department worked.
Unlike, oh my God, the painful one.
QHFDs.
QHFDs.
Qualified HSA funding distributions.
Yeah,
that's
just a hard
QHFDA. And then the replacement for NAFTA is the same way. It's not pronounced. It's not an acronym anymore. It's just a jumble of letters together.
I don't know what that one is.
Yeah, it's the... I don't even say it. Okay. No, it's,
but anyways, back to his worry that perhaps the government will change the rules later. I wouldn't worry about that. Even if they stopped allowing QLACs for one reason or another, they would grandfather the ones that are in there. So I often tell people the government does a lot of crappy things to us, but they generally do grandfather us in. Okay. Back to his first two issues, because there was some moving parts to this that I wanted to get to. He's 43. His wife is 43. He's trying to put a plan in place to help his wife and also reduce required minimum distributions for her because he has a short life expectancy and will die probably by age 60. So his wife could be a widow for 20, 25, 30 years or more,
right?
Quite possibly.
Mm-hmm.
So he has two questions with QLACs. What's the earliest? I guess he's asking, are we too young at 43 to buy a QLAC? And is there a minimum age we recommend before buying a QLAC? Well, first of all, listener, I'm not convinced you need a QLAC. It's possible you could use a QLAC or its cousin, a DIA, D-I-A, Deferred Income Annuity, which is essentially the same chassis as a QLAC, it just can be owned outside of an IRA or inside of a Roth IRA, because a QLAC can only be owned inside an IRA. And a QLAC is a deferred income annuity. You're going to put money in, and you're going to wait. Your wife's only 43, you're 43. You're going to put money in at 43 and maybe wait to 83, Chris. 40 years before taking out money. The problem is, I don't know if you need any more guaranteed income for life. Remember, the L in QLAC is longevity. You, listener, don't have longevity, unfortunately, based on what you shared with us in your email. And I'm sorry for your condition. And it starts to get me to think, there's a lot of things running through my mind right now. The first is, wait a minute, before anyone at age 43 buys a QLAC or its cousin, a DIA.
Yeah, or any annuity.
Or any annuity.
Make sure you need one.
Make sure you need lifetime guaranteed income. I have put two people in the not too distant past, or helped two people in the not too distant past, actually is a better way of saying it, helped those people evaluate the merits of a deferred income annuity, not a QLAC, because they used a Roth IRA to fund this so the income would be tax-free. And the reason both of them, and the reason I supported it, and both people were in their 40s, one was 42, the other was 47. The reason I supported both, neither one of them were eligible for Social Security or a pension. They worked for an employer that opted out of Social Security when they could years and years and years ago, and those employers did not offer a traditional pension anymore. They offered a 401k only, with a hell of a good match, but only a 401k defined contribution plan, not a pension defined benefit plan. So these people, Chris, had no guaranteed income in the future. All of their retirement was based on the variability of the equity markets. So they directed some of their money into a deferred income annuity inside their Roth IRAs, which is essentially a QLAC that would be owned inside a regular IRA, that would pay them a stated amount of money in the future, in their 70s or 80s, when they turned it on. And we used the deferred income annuity provider that allowed the income to be turned on at any time after 18 months from the last premium payment in. So it gave them a huge amount of flexibility after they retired in their 60s to decide when they want to turn this income on. Okay, that said, that's the only time I ever recommended someone in their 40s consider one of these style products like you are. Now, you alluded to or mentioned you are also considering doing this to defer required minimum distributions. Again, without enough information on how much money you're estimating your required minimum distributions are going to be and how much income you're going to need, that might be a moot point, reducing RMDs. Right. If you need the required minimum distribution, there's no need to be deferring it. If you need it, you got to take it.
If you're going to be taking money out anyway, it's a moot point, like you said.
Absolutely. So I'm a little hesitant to say you need one. I think you need to do a little more number crunching. But that said, listener, you need to look at a few other aspects here that might ixnay your QLAC idea. So in addition to trying to determine if you need one, let's look at how you should fund it. If you want it inside a Roth IRA, so the lifetime guaranteed income stream is 100% tax-free, which to me is better than taxable, you would not want to use a QLAC because that can only be owned inside an IRA. You would use a deferred income annuity, which operates the same, but it's a type of annuity that is allowed in a Roth IRA. A QLAC is not allowed in a Roth IRA. But the second thing, listener, is you didn't tell me who has the IRA account. You see, if the IRA is in your name, let's say you have the IRA account. Let's just say your wife is a stay-at-home mom, and I don't know if she is. You didn't share it with me. So she doesn't have the IRA. You have the big IRA. And since the limit in going into a QLAC is $130,000, let's just say you were planning on putting $130,000 into the QLAC. You're doing this because you have a short life expectancy and you want to make sure your wife has additional secure income. I like that. Let's assume also, Chris, he crunched the numbers and it does make sense for additional secure income. I don't want you to just willy-nilly buy one. You've actually researched it and it makes sense. Here's the issue, listener. You would have to purchase, because the IRA is yours and you want to benefit your wife, you would have to purchase a joint life QLAC. But you don't have an L. Remember I said the L in QLAC stands for longevity. Qualified Longevity Annuity Contract. You don't have an L, But when you buy a joint life QLAC, why would it have to be joint life? The IRA in my example is in your name. If the IRA is in your name and you're thinking, I, meaning you, am going to buy a QLAC for the benefit of my wife inside my IRA, you can do that because you're married and the IRA can be inherited by her as if it was her own. And the government would allow the joint payee to continue, you will have a joint life payout, which would be smaller than a single life payout. If you're going to pass away at 60, but your wife could live well into her 80s or 90s, you shouldn't even be entertaining a joint life payout, which could have payments 20 to 30% lower than a single life payout, even though you may pass away 10, 12, 15 years after opening it, your wife is going to be locked into those low payments forever.
A related question that I don't think we've talked about before, and I will admit, because I don't do much with QLACs personally, I don't know the answer to this, so, and I don't know that you do. We might have to come back to this, but what if he gets a single life payout QLAC in his IRA, but before turning it on, he passes away and his wife inherits that IRA? What happens to that QLAC where he was the single life beneficiary?
I know the answer to that.
You do?
Absolutely.
Perfect. Share it with us.
Well, first of all, we talked about this on our three-part QLAC show.
Oh. Well, I burned out after about one and a half parts of that.
And apparently it was in the pot.
Well, that was like 2 years
ago.
Too.
It was. I don't even think it's on the website anymore. Okay, so before I answer that question, Peter.
Chris.
Thank you. I was thinking
Peter. Peter hasn't been in here for 3 months.
He was in here just a couple weeks ago.
It feels like 3 months.
Now I lost my train of thought. Oh, back to your question, listener. Is there a minimum age for buying a QLAC? No, if you are certain the QLAC makes sense. If you're unsure, don't buy one, because a QLAC is an irrevocable decision. Once you buy it, there's no going back. So you have to be adamant. Now, I will say, the earlier you buy it, the more income you're going to get, quite substantial more income. So if it does make sense to buy one for your wife, especially if it's in her IRA, which would be the ideal situation, not inside your IRA, listener, because you have short life expectancy. So you will have to do a joint QLAC. And in a joint QLAC, they're going to look at two life expectancies and they're going to reduce those payments by 20, 30% over a single life payment. And if you passed away 10, 12, 15 years into buying them, your wife is locked into low joint payout, even though she's now essentially a widower for the rest of her life. But assuming it makes sense for the wife to own one, I would buy it inside her IRA as a single life payment. That way her payments will be higher and she can defer it well into
up to
85. Mm-hmm. Then he wants to know, how does it actually decrease your RMD? It doesn't really, well, it does decrease. It decreases in the sense, let's say $130,000 went into the QLAC. That $130,000 is exempt from required minimum distributions, even though you've never taken any money out on it. So the government's just going to say, look, you don't have to include the value of the QLAC in your RMD calculation.
Right.
But you cannot delay it past age 85. That's all.
Yep.
And then when it begins at age 85 or earlier, and I would recommend, listener, the providers who will allow your wife to turn on the income payment any time after 18 months. If she bought it with a lump sum payment of $130 at age 43, she could turn it on at 45, a year and a half later.
If she wanted.
If she wanted to. Or any time thereafter.
Just gives you the flexibility, especially when you're talking about 40 years
so
here.
You can't, right. I would only insist on that. And on the two people I helped that I alluded to, Both of them chose to use the company that does allow that flexibility because at 40-something, they couldn't decide when they were going to turn it on. Most other QLAC providers, you have to tell them when you're going to turn it on, and most people choose age 85, and it gives them flexibility to turn it on anywhere between 80 and 85. That's not enough flexibility. And that's an insurance company rule, not a Department of Treasury rule. Okay, so that said, back to what Chris is now saying. Did it make sense why I think his wife should put it in a single life,
Absolutely.
Not a joint? Okay. Chris asked, what if he, though, meaning you, listener, bought the QLAC as a joint or a single?
Single life.
As a single life. And or the wife bought one as a single life in her IRA, thinking she was going to live longer than him because he has the short life expectancy. Would that be?
But she died. Doesn't
but
matter.
She passes
The point
away.
Is, what happens in the inherited
right.
IRA?
So here's what happens, because it's a single life. If it's a joint life, no problem. The IRA of the decedent now, or the QLAC of the decedent, all of a sudden becomes the QLAC of the spouse, who happens to be the joint income beneficiary, and it's no big problem. That's easy.
Yep.
But when you take a single life QLAC, when you open the QLAC, you're going to be given two choices. The first, I guess the first one really isn't a choice because it's kind of become the default. When QLACs were first proposed by the Department of Treasury, the rule was if someone died while the QLAC was in deferral stage, the money is lost. And the Department of Treasury wanted that in there for a reason, Chris. They wanted it in there because of the AC. Remember, the Q is qualified, which means it's inside an IRA. That's all that means. L is longevity, annuity contract, AC. And they wanted to maximize the amount of income that you would get in a QLAC.
Right.
Well, if you mandated that all money remaining in a QLAC, if someone died before receiving it, has to be shared with all other members in that QLAC pool, because that's what would have happened to it. The money wouldn't have gone to the insurance company. The government wanted it all to be shared with everyone else, meaning you get even bigger QLAC payments.
Get mortality credits.
So, yeah, they're called mortality credits. Yes, the other QLAC members would have got a lot more money, but nobody would have bought QLACs.
Right, because they're so worried about "quote unquote" wasting the money. The
correct.
Money not
nobody would have bought
them,
yeah. And that's what we in the industry, because the Department of Treasury opened this up for comments, and we in the industry wrote to the Department of Treasury, said, "Look, I can tell you now, no one's going to buy these if you make that the mandatory rule." So the government came out and did a 180, and they said death that occurs prior to income beginning, the QLAC will have a 100% return of premium.
As the default.
As the default.
But you could request the other, the old way, right?
I don't want to say yes to that because every single QLAC I have done has always had that ROP, and every client has always wanted that ROP, return of premium.
So you don't get any benefit for being in there necessarily or at all. Nope. You're going to get the 130 back in our hypothetical. So that's what would happen if the person died before turning on the annuity part of the QLAC.
Yes. The money
if they have return of premium.
The money will be paid out. It will also be paid out in one lump sum as a distribution from the QLAC.
Oh, it doesn't just go back in. Oh, from the QLAC, but stays in the IRA.
No.
Oh, see, that's a little hiccup.
That's a little hiccup. Okay, so that's what happens if you die before income begins with a single life QLAC.
Okay.
Joint life QLAC, no problem.
Right.
The joint just owner steps in.
Yep,
steps in. But on a single life, to get that extra payment, that extra 20, 30% a year forever, you take a single life, and if you die beforehand, before income begins, then when you open the QLAC, they're going to ask you, what do you want to happen after the income begins? So you die after the income begins, but before you receive all your money back. Now that is a totally optional payment for you. You can choose it. It's called the death benefit or the installment refund. But that is an option. The government isn't mandating anything on that. The return of premium goes away the minute income begins. Now, if you put in $130,000 and you die after getting $30,000, there's still $100,000 in the QLAC. If you chose, when you opened the QLAC, if you chose the single life, no installment refund or no death benefit, you will get more money because you're going to get mortality credits. Now, if you're willing to share, you get to share in people who died before you. So you'll get a higher payment, but your beneficiaries get nothing. But if you want to make sure the $130,000 you put in is never lost, then you would choose the installment refund or the lump sum cash refund, otherwise known as a death benefit option, that will pay your beneficiaries in one lump sum, no stretch out, one lump sum, all unreturned premiums as a lump sum taxable distribution in the year of death.
But installment refund, they continue the payments until the $130,000 has been returned.
Correct.
Yeah.
Installment refund will draw out the payments right. a little longer than the one lump sum.
So those options, as you choose them, if think of it this way, if you're choosing an option that benefits you, you're going to get less as a promised monthly or yearly benefit from it. If it's you choose an option that's more favorable for the insurance company, they reward you for choosing that option by making the payments to you a little higher. So that's the trade-off. There's no free lunch. It's a trade-off, but you do have some choices.
And let me add some clarity. A DIA, the cousin of a QLAC mm-hmm. that can be owned outside of an IRA or inside of a Roth IRA, gives you the option of installment refund or lump sum payout. However, I believe the QLAC is just a death benefit lump sum option. Because the law is pretty specific.
Because otherwise the IRA would have to stay open Correct. To get those out. So
and
I
the
bet
IRS,
you're right.
When the Department of Treasury yeah. created this, they said in the year of death, it's paid out in one lump sum in 1 year.
To clean it up.
So I
yeah.
think it is only a lump sum payout.
Okay. But a DIA would give you that more flexibility.
A DIA would yeah. give you the installment refund or
sense.
The lump sum.
That makes sense. Glad we
clarified okay,
that.
So anyways, I just wanted to clarify that a little. I'm not sure. I feel bad for him having a condition that may cause his demise at age 60. I admire him for wanting to simplify things for his spouse. I think having a QLAC would be a wonderful thing for her. It could sit there and grow for 40-plus years. The income that a QLAC deferred for 40 years could generate would be astronomical. But just do some research to make sure it's truly needed. And then, if you're going to buy one, I would try or consider buying it in her name as a single life rather than your name as a joint life. Because if you did pass away just a decade or so into it and your wife still has 30, 40 years before she even turns it on, you're really going to be locking your wife into low payments and there's only really one person taking it.
Right.
It's a joint life payout for one person. And that just doesn't yep. make sense.
Well, that music means we got to bail out of here. Well, this is kind of a long Q&A. We're at an hour and 23 minutes already.
Wow, there were three more I wanted to get to
today. I know. It's not going
to
happen.
We may have to do two weekly Q&As and one
easy.
EBU.
Easy.
Just saying. Listeners, if you'd like two weekly Q&As, feel free to write to Chris at chris@jimhelps.com and implore him, because he's the only one who knows how to run the recording equipment. We got to get Jack trained on recording equipment. He's techie. He can probably figure that out.
If it means I don't have to do these anymore, I might be interested in that.
You're all for it? All right. Well, we will see you guys next week. Same bat time, same bat channel. If you have any questions, comments, or obscene remarks, feel free to send them to Jim at Jim Helps. That's Jim at JimHelps.com. Chris and I, we like to point out to all our listeners, we are living, breathing, practicing financial planners in the state of Colorado. We enjoy doing this Q&A show once a week on iTunes, maybe twice a week.
Once
a
week?
Yeah, we do it once a week.
Yeah, we enjoy it once a week.
Oh, you're saying you wouldn't enjoy it twice a week?
I don't think we'd enjoy it twice a week.
But we'd get through this pile of emails.
Sure.
But if you have a question, go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Click on the Contact Us button, or just feel free to fire us off an email at jim@jimhelps.com, and we'll get to that question as soon as we can. And also, as we always say, if you feel we could be of benefit to you, we do have a practicing financial planning firm. We work with people throughout the United States. And you can schedule what is called a coffee and a second opinion phone call. Just give you a chance to talk with us over the phone, see if there's a way our firm may be able to help you. If so, we'll explain how and how much it would cost. And if not, we'll explain why and hopefully point you in the direction of someone who might be a better fit. But our firm specializes in retirement planning and distribution planning. This is all we do. It's not a bullet point listed on our website under a dozen and a half other things that we do. Retirement planning is all we do. So if you're looking for someone that you can pay a fee to and get some unbiased advice, we might be a good fit for you. Give us a call and let's chat.
Perfect. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us this week. We'll be back with you next week. Not again this week, because we only do this once a week.
We'll maybe
next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.